An evening of lively, smart conversation and jazz. Join me, John Williams, for a live taping of the Mincing Rascals podcast, Robert's Pizza, and Jazz, Wednesday, June 12th, 6 to 8 at Winter's Jazz Club in Streeterville. Tickets at WGNRadio.com/rascals.
On this week's Mincing Rascals, it's about the lying game, the lies of Trump and Clinton, and how both sides have baskets of deplorables.
Today is Friday. It is September 16th, 2016. I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals, a portion of which will be broadcast, as always, on my Saturday show at 1:30 on WGN.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
And I'm Krista McQuarrie, the dazzling member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board.
Here we go.
Wait for it.
I'm Eric Zorn, the plucky columnist of the Tribune.
Plucky. Plucky.
Now we have to use those words again somewhere else in the podcast. So.
Yeah, they do need to pop up organically, as
yes.
it were.
All right.
I am happy to report that all of us do have letters today from our doctors saying that we are in excellent health, and if elected, we will be the healthiest Mincing Rascals ever. My view is that Donald Trump so little regards the truth or American people that he even lied about his weight on Dr. Oz. He may be 6'3", kids, but that's more than 236 pounds we're looking at. It doesn't matter, of course, but the process does, it seems, this year. We don't talk about issues. We talk about how they talk about things. So, Eric, what did you make of the big Dr. Oz Donald Trump reveal?
I never had a lot of doubt about Donald Trump's basic health as a 70-year-old man. He seems fairly robust as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm.
I also did not share all of the concerns that people seem to have about Hillary Clinton's health. She's been working really hard. She's been on the campaign trail a lot. The National Enquirer has been predicting her death. And the right wing, you know, Alex Jones and those people have claimed that she's had some terrible disease. I think that that's all nonsense. I mean, we can get into the rest of the story, but the health thing is not anything that really obsesses me. So I'm going to have to defer to my other rascals here. Maybe some of them are.
Steve Bertrand. Go ahead, Kristen.
I'm not obsessed with it. I think it's important to, you know, reveal some sort of doctor report to show that you're not going to, you know, pass away. And it was known before the election. But, I mean, we have to acknowledge that Hillary Clinton fainted. And it was caught by somebody on cell phone, so that ramped up all the discussion this week. And then it did become pretty relevant, I think.
She is Wile E. Coyote, and Donald Trump is the roadrunner. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. You know, every time it looks as if he's being cornered into telling a little more truthiness, he gets away with it, you know. And for the first time, six weeks ago, I would have told you that a Donald Trump presidency was unimaginable. I'm starting to imagine it because I think not a single rule applies to him, and he knows how to work it, and it's paying off.
An excellent example of this happened earlier this week, the middle of this week, when he went to Flint, Michigan. He went to an African-American church there, and he stood up and he was talking about the water crisis, and then he started eliding into a campaign speech. And the pastor kind of got up and came and said, you know, Mr. Trump, please, we want to keep the focus on Flint. And he said, very respectfully. He said, okay, fine, thank you. And then he finished up pretty quickly and went away. And the audience at the church, you know, you see the video and hear the audio of this. The audience was heckling him, was not on his side. So the next day he goes on Fox and Friends, and he tells a story that is completely at odds with what you see on that video. It is as brazen a misrepresentation of what happened as Hillary Clinton saying she came under fire landing in a Bosnian airport.
Which she's still paying for.
Which she is still paying for years and years later. Trump does this so reflexively, so impulsively.
What did he say? I didn't see
He said that the woman was really nervous.
And that she had
a political agenda.
And the audience was on his side and was chanting to let him speak. All these things were just false.
This minister equally respectfully shot down a member of the crowd when he started ridiculing Donald Trump. She said, "This is my church and you're not going to do it here." So she did it for both sides.
Yeah, it was.
I'm pointing a lot, Kristen.
I know,
I'm sorry.
Both of you, you're pointing over me. I guess I would just point out that when you say like rules don't apply, and you start and I saw the scene of the pastor, you know, whispering to him, and he backed off. If you haven't been to a black church lately, there is a lot of politicking that goes on.
No, but
in black
he agreed
churches.
To give the speech.
It is totally accepted.
It doesn't
campaign.
He,
uh, It doesn't. It is an accepted. If you are a white politician in Chicago, you want to get in front of black churches.
It doesn't matter. If he had complained about that, that's fine. He told a different story than the story that happened. If he wanted to tell the true story of what happened there and complain that he's being held to a different standard, that's a different issue.
And you're that confident that you saw beginning to end the entire thing. And
absolutely, I'm confident in this. And I mean, you can't deny, Kristen, that this guy lies reflexively and constantly. He's lying this morning.
They both do.
He lies way more than she does.
No, they don't. We have to stop that. We have got to stop this.
This false equivalence, I think, is really.
Let me tell you something.
It's irresponsible. It's at an irresponsible level.
This speaks to the boring level of my life. I can remember 25 years ago watching C-SPAN and watching Alan Greenspan, or Alan Simpson, you know, the great American curmudgeon, the former Republican senator from Wyoming, giving a speech to the young Republicans in the 90s, and I still remember it. And he said something about the media. He said, you know, you people have got to watch the media, because the media, in an effort to what they think is fairness, there can be a vote in the U.S. Senate that's 99-1. And the media, in the name of fairness, will give the one voter the same attention as the 99, that there's no perspective. And that's where we are right now with this. I mean, Donald Trump saying today that Hillary Clinton started the birther movement and he ended it. It was interesting, right after he gave that speech, both the New York Times and Washington Post in their characterization said Donald Trump falsely claimed, which I think is turning a corner a little bit.
There's no evidence, we are giving it
an equivalency that is mind-boggling, mind-numbing, infuriating, and that's why I can imagine a Trump presidency.
Did you read what PolitiFact traced back the origins of the birther movement? It did not come from Hillary Clinton. It didn't come from her campaign, but it came from her supporters, who then started a website talking all about it and trying to gin up support when she withdrew from the race with Obama. So it did come from her supporters.
He said it came from Hillary Clinton.
He did, and
he's
wrong about that. But lots of people over the years have made that leap.
Do you think there's an equality in the level of lying in this campaign? I mean, Hillary Clinton certainly has issues with her truthiness as well. Absolutely. Do you think they're equal?
I think if she spoke like a normal person and did press conferences, that yes, there would probably be more press coverage of her statements regarding A, B, and C. But she doesn't talk to the press. Well, she doesn't speak publicly. She never goes off script.
He lies in speeches. Do you think that the level of untruth is equal between the two of them?
I mean, I'm not going to answer that question, Steve, because if we're going to sit here and he lied about the way that, or he misrepresented this appearance that he had in front of a black church. I mean, why do we get so upset about him lying about his
weight? Because he said he was going to release his medical records. He said he was going to release his tax records. He lies every day.
The tax return thing, I'm totally with you.
And the Republicans have been obsessing about her lie about landing in the Bosnia airport for however many years.
We should have another Benghazi hearing.
I mean, he's lying about the Hillary Clinton things. She did not start the birther movement. She never said anything to advance that movement. And it basically died as soon as she got out of the race. The people who were upset, they were like crazy Hillary partisans, and they forgot about it. It was dead. He fanned the flames of this racist
idea. What troubles me, Kristen.
He fanned those flames for eight years.
He led the birther movement. He was the birther in chief.
Listen,
the birther movement is ridiculous. It came from what I would describe as the really radical right wing of the Republican Party, the Tea Party people. They were wrong, and they were wrong to keep fanning it. But Donald Trump was not around. I mean, he was nowhere on the scene in 2008, 9, 10, when it was being perpetuated.
It was his pressure that forced the birth certificate to eventually be revealed. I mean, he says that. Is that true or untrue?
I don't know the answer to that.
He says he ended it today, and he says, you all know what I mean, and that was by forcing the birth certificate to be revealed.
The birth certificate came out in 2011, and he's still been picking at that scab for the last
14 years. Other than, the tweet.
In interviews all the time. There's all kinds of interviews where he said. In fact, even earlier this year, he said, I'm not talking about that anymore, rather than saying that it wasn't true. What bothers me, Kristen, is I have huge respect for you and, you know, like you and everything. And when we were talking about whether or not Trump was lying or uttering a mistruth about Hillary Clinton starting it, you almost defended him by saying, well, her people did. I mean, I just think he's getting a pass on these things.
I just want us to be accurate. And I do think that the media has a tendency to jump on something he says. And then if you actually go back and watch the whole reel, they do take things out of context. And what I don't like is when the media attacks him for something, but they look the other way when it comes to
the left. I just don't see that happening. I don't see her getting a pass on anything. Her being, you know, she's the one who's not transparent. She's the one who's released medical records far in excess of his. She's the one who's released tax returns.
Yes,
and she's the one who's called not transparent. You know, Donald Trump Jr. today on Good Morning America saying, well, we'll put his businesses in a blind trust. Us kids will run it. That's not a blind trust.
Who are you mad at, Steve? Are you mad at Hillary? Are you mad at the media?
John,
you mad at the American people? Because they're the one. This is not that difficult to discern what you're saying, but people don't seem to care.
That's my point.
I am mad at everyone who is drawing a breath on this Friday. No, it goes back to I mean it. It's like Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. There's no stopping him, no matter what it is. So I don't know who I'm mad at. It's just,
well, I feel bad for Kristen McQuarrie today, because PolitiFact regularly, if you look it up, they say 70% of the things that Donald Trump says are pants on fire, not true, or generally not true. And Hillary Clinton is more than 50% of the time telling the absolute truth. I regret, Kristen, that you're being put in a box to defend Donald Trump, who I don't think you support, but you so dislike Hillary Clinton that that's the position you find yourself in.
You know,
you can't win.
I don't really dislike Hillary Clinton. I am just hypersensitive to when the media goes after him in a way that they don't her or that side of the argument. And that's where my radar goes up. And as for the PolitiFact, I'm not defending Donald Trump on the birther issue. I'm simply repeating what I read that PolitiFact, where it actually came from.
No, but you are, because you said it was – he said it was her, and you said, well, it was people who liked her.
Isn't the worst of it, though, that he rides the wave of mistrust or hate? He has always been in a position to put it down, but he either rides it or furthers it. I don't really care if it was Hillary or Hillary's people that started it. I maybe do a little bit if I thought this was really an issue anyway, but I think it's more about the way he runs the show. He's happy to foment mistrust or hate and then stand back and say, well, other people are saying that, when, in fact, he is in a position to put it down, and he absolutely doesn't. And he has an audience, Steve.
I agree with this is the last thing I'll say. I agree with what you're saying, but we haven't even talked about Hillary calling half of his supporters deplorables
let's go back, homophobes, and
everything else. So we're spending all this time.
No, I agree with Kristen. You're right. Let's go back. Because the last podcast we did was Friday, and it was Friday night that the basket of deplorables remark was made. So we have all that to catch up on. Kristen, tell the story, and then we'll get into it. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, you know, she was at a fundraiser in Hollywood, wasn't she?
No, New York. It
no,
was
New York.
An
okay,
LGBT.
You guys tell it, because I only – I saw a clip.
She was an LGBT fundraiser. Barbara Streisand was there, and she gave these remarks. And I mean, and Eric, I think it was Thursday, because you and I talked about it. Well, whenever. No, whatever. But she gave prepared remarks. And she said, you know, that half of Donald Trump's supporters are what I call belong in the basket of deplorables, homophobes, xenophobes, Islamophobes.
Yeah, I think that's all the phobes.
All the phobes.
And she also said, and the other half,
racist.
And the other half of them have lost hope. They're angry at everybody.
Speaking of a longer quote, had you kept it longer, she was a sympathetic or understanding of the other half.
That half never gets played.
Well, because the first half was a big mistake.
If context matters at all, the media didn't do her any favors by chopping that quote in half. Okay, so Eric, what about that?
Okay, first of all, you look at the
you just slammed his coffee cup down.
If you look at the polls, you look at when they poll Trump supporters, you'll find that this notion that half of them are either racist or Islamophobic or xenophobic or all the various phobes, that's basically true. And this comment gave a chance for a lot of news organs to go and look at these polls and say, hey, you know, this is not out of bounds. That half he does give great comfort and support to people and they really like him. You know, people who are deplorable by that definition.
He has raised them up, I think, in her words.
He has raised them up is what she said.
I think that
is true. I think that is true, that he does have a lot of support among people who hold views that I consider deplorable, she considers deplorable.
Okay, but what are those, Eric? I mean, 69% of people who say they're going to vote for Trump do not believe Barack Obama was born in the United States. And a high percentage of them believe that he's Islamic. And a high percentage of them think that blacks are lazier. And they think that LGBT citizens should not have the same rights as mainstream America.
31% of South Carolina voters who supported him thought that homosexuals should be banned from entering the country.
Stuff like that.
1 in 3.
Okay. So those are deplorable views, and those people support Donald Trump. Right. So is Hillary wrong when she says that's a basket of deplorables?
See, I don't think – I mean, first of all, no, I don't think she's wrong to say that. I don't even think politically it was that big a mistake. I know that that
– I know, no, politically I know that was a
big
mistake.
I know that puts me in the minority, but it put that issue front and center, and that's where the Hillary Clinton campaign wanted it. They wanted it away from the Clinton Foundation story.
Well, you think this helps or hurts her more, Eric?
I think it helps her. Name somebody out there who's going to vote. Who's going to vote for her? Who's going to say, well, I was going to vote for her, but
the national polls shifted on that line, Eric. She lost points across the country this week because of
I did a column on this on Wednesday, and I thought that defending the deplorables remark, but pointing out that she then had that momentum and it all went away when she wobbled and was.
Well, what do you mean wobbled?
She had pneumonia. She was diagnosed with pneumonia on Friday.
Yes,
I am.
That cost her more than the line
I think
about,
it did because it was.
Shame on us.
Well, no, she needs to be more candid, more transparent about this. If she's got a health problem, she's got to just come out and say, "Hey, look, I've been diagnosed with pneumonia. I'm going to take a couple days off the trail." That's what she should have said.
Don't you have a right to privacy? She's running for president.
This woman is unable just to be candid with people. And Kristen is right. She's pointed this out before. This woman, there's something congenital in Hillary Clinton that she just can't be transparent. She's got this penchant for secrecy, and it has served her so poorly. Axelrod quoted about it famously, I think, on Monday.
Her speech in North Carolina when she came back to the trail said, "When it comes to public policy, I'm much better at the policy than I am at the public."
You know, sure, she's a terrible candidate. She's a terrible candidate. But I'm still surprised that in this day and age of HIPAA, that we think that we have a right to know the details of somebody's personal
health. Here's the thing, John.
That's secrecy?
Can we get back to the deplorables comment for a minute?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Mom.
So I'm sorry. I'm going to pull up a recent Reuters Ipsos poll. This is not a partisan organization. That basically said that it paints a depressing picture of the United States electorate's opinions on race. The main takeaways are, yes, more of the people who identified with Donald Trump had racist views, but Hillary Clinton supporters are definitely there, too.
Yeah.
And if you go through the list, it is like, 33% of Trump supporters think that blacks are less intelligent. 22% of those who identified with Hillary said the same thing. So I think there is a very ugly side of America that maybe that definitely Donald Trump is tapping into, and we're seeing it. But I refuse to believe it's half of his supporters. It is the fringe part of this party, just like there is a deplorable fringe part of the Democratic
Agreed.
Party who think it's fine to run around and, you know, shoot at cops, call them pigs. You give somebody like Al Sharpton, who has nothing nice to say about Jewish people, calls white people crackers, and he is a host on MSNBC.
It's a terrible show, by the way.
There are fringe parts of both parties that are very ugly and are part of this country.
You're right. Absolutely right. Here's the difference. One candidate is lifting them up and the other isn't. I just think that's a difference. I think Donald Trump is speaking to those people when he talks about, or refuses to condemn or whatever, the David Duke thing, when he talks about the Muslim ban, when he goes to the Mexican rapist. I think he's speaking to them. Hillary Clinton is not looking to her deplorables, for the votes like
I agree with you. I agree with you. I was watching a CNN reporter the other day. She got into a back and forth with someone, and she's on the campaign trail with Trump every single day at all these rallies. And she says every single day someone she interviews says something ignorant and awful. I don't think you can deny that that is true.
This poll that Kristen referenced is really depressing, actually, because it does show, yes, there are there is a percentage, and not insignificant percentage, of Hillary Clinton supporters, of Democrats, who are, belong in this basket of deplorables too. And I think that it pays for all of us to recognize that, to realize that we can't. That it's not like the Democratic Party doesn't have its deplorable people on that end, but all, and also, and Kristen points out, some people who are on the other end who are calling policemen pigs and so on. I mean, that's definitely true. But again, to echo Steve's point, which candidate is speaking to our higher natures and which candidate is speaking to our baser natures? And I think that is really the key distinction here.
I want to talk about Americana for a second. Colin Kaepernick, the San Francisco 49ers, now backup quarterback, doesn't stand for the national anthem. And other athletes in other sports and in the NFL are not doing it anymore, all the way down to high school athletes. And where you thought that might be a one-off, it's resonating in many different ways, isn't it? A former alderman in the city of Chicago wants the council to draft an ordinance that will designate the rules by how you stand for the national anthem in the city. There is a sports marketer that we talked to on another radio station I work at, and he wants the NFL to mandate that all of the players on all of the teams actually stand for the national anthem. There's a high school kid in the Chicago area who was pulled up out of his seat for the Pledge of Allegiance, and now that story is sort of resonating. I'm a little surprised by all of this. I suppose we all agree that you have a First Amendment right and that you don't have to stand or say the pledge. We all on the same page on that?
Sure, yeah. But I think the NFL could make them do it, right?
Because they're employees?
They make them wear certain garments, and they, you know.
Nobody controls people more, right? You can't write "Hi, Mom" on your socks that you don't get a fine in the NFL. And there they are taking knees, sometimes holding hands, raising the fist, the Black Power fist, during the national anthem. And you know the NFL doesn't like that. But I think if they went that direction, everybody would be on a knee. Everybody would be raising a fist.
Yeah, I think that the importance of being able to, the freedom not to stand for the national anthem is one of the freedoms that, and a lot of military people have said this, and veterans have said this, like, that's one of the freedoms that I fought for.
And I also don't think it's a hollow point. I mean, we defend their right to do it, but sometimes we don't like what they're saying. You might feel the same way about somebody burning the flag. I know you might have the right to do it, but, gee, I wish you wouldn't do it that way. But I think that the message that Colin Kaepernick and some of them are trying to send, and it's not being that well received or heard, is that blacks don't get equal treatment in this country, and they're going to protest the national anthem. You and I might not even agree with that, but I think, you know, they're coming by that opinion honestly. I think that's a reasonable thing to say if you don't like the way they're saying it.
It's a pretty peaceful way to draw attention to your cause, right? You're not out there stopping traffic. You're not. I mean, seriously, I mean, it's
what would be more offensive to you, Eric, if they shut down Michigan Avenue again or if they went to a knee before the Bears game and protested the national anthem?
I think it's a perfectly acceptable form of protest, and it has continued the conversation, just like when it was a Tommy Smith and John Carlos. Back in the Olympics in 68. I mean, that drew attention to their cause, and that's what protest does, and that's what we can do in this country. I just think it's just something that people should let play out. And also, I don't think that school children should be compelled to say the Pledge of Allegiance every day. I don't think people should be compelled to stand for the national anthem. And it provoked some interesting conversations about why we do this before sporting events, and what does it mean when you stand for the national anthem? What are you standing? I mean, when I stand for the national anthem, which I do, I stand for what this country stands for, the best of this country. I obviously have problems. Everybody at this table, everybody listening has got issues with the way the government has been working, the way various government institutions have been working. I don't think, what the national anthem is about. It is about the American ideal. It's about the American experiment. But I accept that other people don't see it that way and that they have a different message that they want to convey when they don't stand.
What's the answer? Why do we stand before sporting events?
It goes back. It was commercial. Apparently, there was at some point back in the distant past where it may have even been the Cubs or something. I don't know. Where they decided they would play the national anthem, and they started doing it, and people liked it, and then it just became a tradition. I mean, we don't do it before plays, right? We don't do it before.
No, and I don't know if other countries do it before their. Does Manchester United stand? Do they?
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm going to try to look this up while we're talking, but there was a college coach who yesterday, I think, came out with a very reasonable answer. And he basically said, when you're doing that before the game, then you are making, you're making it about the team and the college. If you have a problem with it, go to a protest march, hold a press conference, you know, do it in other places in your life. But to not stand for the national anthem and to make it a spectacle in the middle of the game, then you are drawing in the team. And I'm just going to say this. I do think not standing for the, you know, if you can't bring yourself to just stand on your feet and be grateful for one thing, and that is to be born in this country. We are luckier than most people on the planet just by being born here. And if you, and if you're so self-centered that you can't stand for the national anthem, I do think that's deplorable. I also think you have a right to do it, and the First Amendment protects deplorable speech. We're using deplorable a lot
I
today.
Think that,
and we haven't used plucky once, by the way.
Shoot.
Well, she's not deplorable. Gosh. What was your adjective?
She was dazzling.
Was I dazzling? Yeah. I don't even remember.
You were at the beginning and not since, I have to say.
I know. I'm sorry.
But no, I think that sitting down during the national anthem is insulting to the people who stand. I wish there was a different way.
Right, it puts the other guys on the sidelines in a conundrum.
I mean the people in the stands. I think in a way it insults them. I think raising a fist or finding some other way to do something proactively would be more. I don't like any of it really, but it would be a better way to do it. Does that make sense to anyone? That if I sit down while you're standing for something you truly believe in, I think in a way I'm insulting you.
I'm judging you, that's for sure. Yeah. And that's why I hate to see it when the high school kids are doing it. You know, I appreciate Kristen's point that a millionaire quarterback in the NFL ought to appreciate his good fortune, however unhappy he is with other parts of our society. Boy, if anybody ought to be glad to live in the USA, it's Colin Kaepernick, right? But I also hate to see the kids do it because I'd like to think they're still idealistic. I don't think their lives are that bad yet. You know, I mean, they haven't paid taxes like you and I have. So that they are already taking a knee, I think, is premature.
Some high school kids, I mean, I wouldn't generalize. Some of them have had pretty tough lives.
Sure, Eric. I know that.
I actually don't mind this idea that they are becoming more politically aware, that they're actually thinking about this.
If it was their own politics, I'd buy that. But I see it as copycat. Maybe. I see it as that's what we're doing now. Hey, we're black, we're young, we're men. Let's do that. It didn't start there. It started in the NFL, and now they're mimicking.
I'm not a real big fan of compulsory patriotic rituals. I mean, I think it smacks a bit of authoritarian regimes and so on. I think they should be voluntary. I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, displaying the flag, for focusing on what the anthem means, what these symbols mean, and what they don't apply to. I mean, as I said earlier, nobody around this table thinks that the United States is perfect. And the government is perfect, and that when we stand for the national anthem, we are standing because we believe 100% in what the government does and what a president does. I mean, and what the police departments do. That's not what standing up means. And, you know, Kristen said, we are very fortunate to live in this country. This country is imperfect, but it is maybe the least imperfect country, right? I mean, we are glad to be here. We are lucky to be here. And that's, to me, that's what that is about. But I don't find the idea of seeing it another way to be particularly offensive. I think that someone says, like, look, what I see when I stand for the national anthem is an expression of support for things that I don't support, so I'm not going to do that. I understand that. I don't react as strongly as maybe others do to that.
Well, that will be the last word on that because Eric Zorn today has worked 30 years for the Chicago Tribune.
Hey, today? Congratulations.
I've been writing a column for 30 years. Thanks for the card, by the way, Kristen and John. That was really nice.
Steve and Kristen will be getting yours later today.
My first column was 30 years ago Monday.
Congratulations!
That's a lot.
It's been really.
You must be really old.
You know,
I gave me a column when I was in my teens.
When I was just starting, or maybe even an intern at WGN Radio, my first introduction to Eric Zorn was that he was this writer writing a story on radio news for the Columbia Journalism Review.
Oh yeah,
right.
Wow,
you remember that?
Yeah,
and he came into the newsroom and talked to, well, not to me, but to others. And well,
you are beneath notice.
I've been in awe ever since.
The first time I met Eric Zorn was I'm sure he doesn't remember this, but we were at a press conference. I was working at the Daily Southtown. I was writing a column that I was sure no one read. And as we were leaving the press conference, he introduced himself. And I was like all a flutter because Eric Zorn spoke to me. Right. And he's really tall. I didn't know he was so tall.
Yeah, you don't get the sense of that in the little picture that they have there. They should put his medical chart next to it so we'll know how,
right. How much do you weigh, Eric?
What his testosterone level
BMI,
is.
BMI, yeah, right.
Here's the recommendation part of the podcast where we each recommend something that we are listening to, reading, watching, or consuming. Anybody want to go first on this?
Well, mine's a kind of a cop-out. I'm going to resuggest what you suggested before. Or was
Oh, yeah.
The Night Of on HBO.
I thought you'd watched a bunch of episodes when you texted me this
I texted
week.
Him. I'm watching the first one, and it was so hard to watch. I mean, I almost stopped watching it because this sort of doe-eyed kid, innocent kid, just keeps making bad decisions, and you know it's going to end terribly for him. And it does. I'm still only a couple in, but I can't wait to go home and watch another one
tonight.
It's
a 10-part series, and the first episode is the most excruciating first episode of a show you will ever see. And if you stay through it, you'll be glad you did, Steve.
I will, and I hope to.
John Turturro is the guy everybody talks about in this, is his attorney.
And his little brother's in it too, right? He's like the Clint Howard to Ron Howard.
Is that his little brother in that? I didn't know that.
Who plays one of the police officers, I think, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's The Night Of. Great show. What about you, Eric? What do you like this week?
Well, I'm going to endorse the work of a competitor. Neil Steinberg has just published a book called Out of the Wreck I Rise, and it is a book about recovery, and basically, he's gone through literature, drama, songs, and he has plucked out he and his co-author have plucked out a bunch of quotes that are meaningful for people who are going through recovery, as Neil still is. He's an alcoholic, and he's, I think, 10 years sober now. And he has done this book, and I went to a reading last week in which Carol Marine, Rick Kogan, Bill Savage all helped him read from it. And it's got chapter introductions by Neil, who's a very good writer, and the quotes are very powerful. It's a kind of book, I think it's selling really well because people are finding that it is sort of another way of confronting their recovery and their addiction that isn't just platitudes from Alcoholics Anonymous and some of these uplifting organizations, but it's a very gritty book and very interesting, nicely put together.
His first book about that was just so good, and I don't remember the title of
which
it.
Which one, about his alcoholism?
Alcoholism,
it's called
yeah.
Drunkard.
Yeah, exactly. And he's very candid with that and, you know, how that affected his relationship with his wife. His love not just only of alcohol, his anticipation of his next drink, his love of the feel of the glass and the look of the ice. I mean, you could just see him getting intoxicated literally and figuratively by the whole process. He is a really good writer,
yeah,
that's for sure.
Book.
Kristen, what do you like this
week? Oh, you know what? I'm gonna plug this forum that Eric is going to moderate, and I'm serving on a panel the night of the first debate. So I'm not sure when our listeners will be picking up and listening to this podcast, but it's a week from Monday. And if you're in the Chicago area, stop by and watch the debate with us, kind of a little debate party.
What's the calendar date on that?
It's the date.
I was just looking it up.
24th, the first month. It's week from Monday. And it's
26th is the first debate.
It's going to be at the Witt Hotel downtown.
Correct.
And it's going to be me. They say I'm a moderator, but it's just basically going to be me and Kristen and our colleague.
Arguing?
No, we do that in the office with our colleague Darlene Glanton. And we're going to analyze, we're going to talk before the debate, I imagine, about what we're going to expect to see. And then after the debate, we'll see what we saw and who won, who lost.
I was looking at the list of the Emmy nominees, and the show that I've enjoyed the most this year isn't even nominated for Best Drama. Have any of you watched the Netflix series Narcos?
No.
I've heard of it. I've heard it's excellent.
Wow. It is Breaking Bad, only it's true. You know, I mean, relatively true. It's about Pablo Escobar. They actually use authentic footage of him and President Bush and President Reagan back then and what they were doing about the drug war. And it's about the DEA being in Colombia with the local police and local other gangs trying to get Pablo Escobar. It's brilliant. It is very violent. It rings true. And it's one of those things where last night I watched three more episodes of season two because you just can't not want to watch the next episode.
So did you guys ever go out and do anything? It seems like both of you guys just binge watch.
You know what we don't do is no one watches movies anymore. I mean, we in my house, we never watch a movie anymore.
Well, the TV is so good. We're living in its golden age, I really think.
That's true.
And that's this week's Mincing Rascals podcast. Remember, part of this you can hear Saturdays at 1:30 on WGN Radio. Kristen McQuarrie, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate your participation.
She was dazzling.
Right?
The same to you. Eric Zone,
Eric
not so
plucky.
Much.
But he was very plucky.
Congratulations, Eric, for 75 years at the Chicago Tribune. Thanks to Bob Ferguson, our engineer, and Kristen Decker is our producer. We will drop another podcast on you next week.
You're welcome, John.
Okay, kids, good job. Right. Wait a minute. Steve, did I not thank you?
Oh, no, you did. It was great. I appreciate it. I got to go. See ya.
Very defensive and sensitive.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNplus.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.
You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you!